You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Nope, next one again.
Well, you have had no children to bring.
No, I did. No, not Spring and Song, not this one either. Yeah, that's the one. Sorry. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage Mr. Stuart Goldsmith. Thank you very much. Thank you. Are we good? Is that on? Lovely. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming. Sorry, we've had some technical difficulties this morning and made you wait. Many apologies. We'll get stuck straight into it. Just before we start, this is the Comedian's Comedian. Give me a cheer if you've been here before. Good. Give me a cheer if you've heard it on the podcast. Yes, thank Christ. Okay, good. That's good. If you're not familiar with the format, this isn't so much a comedy show as a documentary show about comedy. So I take one comedy headliner per show and interrogate them, really, interview them in depth about... There'll be some waterboarding. And find out how they make their stuff. So I think it's important to say that at the top. There will hopefully, I'm sure, be laughs and jinx and fun along the way. But we're not here to make you laugh. We're here to unpack exactly what it is that makes my guests tick. And today, I'm absolutely thrilled to have these guests. The first guests that I booked onto the show, they're dear friends of mine, and I'm super excited to have them here. Would you please welcome Pappies?
Hey, dude. Hello. Hey, man. Hey.
Have a seat, guys.
Can I just say, we're the first guest you booked, and also the first guest you bumped when Alan Davies wanted to do the date we were doing.
That is... That is also true. That is true. But what the listener at home won't have seen is that in bending down to put your water down,
smugly
after your funny comment, you then lifted your head up and hit it on the microphone.
Yes.
One all.
Stagecraft.
So, guys, hello. Thanks for coming on. Now more so than ever, with the technical issues we've had today, I'm slightly underprepared, but I always panic when I have people that I know and love really well on the show, because I prepare a lot less, expecting that, hey, it's just you dudes, hey, like that. Well done, thank you, well remembered, Neil. He's turned off the incredibly loud fan that's going to screw up the recording. Give it up for Neil, ladies and gentlemen. Your show this year is unbelievably good.
Correct.
This is going to go very smoothly. Can I just find out who here, because I don't want to give anything away if people haven't seen the show. Can we just have a show of hands if you've seen this show, and a show of hands if you've seen Pappies ever? Which is sort of
same
almost
people,
everyone.
Same
here.
People.
That's really good. So for the people that haven't seen you ever, describe what you do in one word.
In one word?
No, in as many words as you like. Just to get people up to speed. And also, I find when I do the podcast, I'm hopefully introducing comics to audiences that won't have seen or heard them before.
Yeah.
Obviously, everyone knows who you are, but there are a couple of listeners in Singapore. So, for the benefit of them.
You have to hold... I'm not holding the microphone to your mouth.
Oh, I like that. I always think what we do is, like, I really like the term gang show, which I've never seen a gang show. I've never seen a gang
show. I type gang show into Google and you don't want to see a gang show.
I prefer the phrase gang show to sketch show, because I think we always try and not be a sketch show. I think we're a sketch troupe, but we never try and make a sketch show. So I like gang show because it sounds more, we try and be a gang on stage and we want the audience to be... Yeah. Involved.
Well, when we first started doing shows, we described on our posters when we were just doing shows pretty much just for our friends and family, we described it as sketch comedy for people who hate sketch comedy. That was the thing, because we gigged, when we first started, we were gigging where there was lots of people who were doing very fourth wally stuff. There were lots of nights full of industry as well. We were like, we're doing the open mic circuit, but in front of like commissioners. It was a really strange thing, the sketch circuit, because there was tons of people there who were, you know, who would eventually become sort of big TV stars who were trying out sketches. And what we always found was the sketches were A, massively overwritten,
yeah.
B, massively over-rehearsed, mm-hmm. C, beautifully dressed, like costume-wise fantastic, and D, unfunny. So it was yeah. insane, wasn't it? Yeah. So people would spend hours, like, and they'd come out in full costume that they'd hired... Yeah. Don't spend money on things. You're not making money. Why spend money? It's, you know, that's the great thing about stand-up is you can just do it, you know? We wanted to do a sort of sketch version of that. And then in 2007, somewhat pretentiously, although we thought it was a joke, no one really got the joke, we described ourselves, do you remember that there were lots of bands like Godspeed You Black Emperor who described themselves as post-rock? We described ourselves as post-sketch.
Nice.
So our 2007 show was a post-sketch show. But I think it's always been, there's nothing, it's very cringeworthy watching sketch comedy when it's going badly. I think there's nothing worse. It's worse than watching bad stand-up, I think. Yeah. Watching bad sketch. Thanks. they've all seen the show. They've all seen the show. But I think that's... So we wanted to make sketch comedy for people who would ordinarily go, oh, I don't really feel like watching sketch.
Mm-hmm.
Bring Clarke in.
I concur. I should explain for the benefit of the listener that I've deliberately only given Pappy's one microphone between the three of them. And what is happening now is that Tom and Matthew are vying for supremacy of the mic and Ben is smiling a lot. So it's nice.
It's kind of what happens anyway. It's fine.
You had something to add to that? If you take the mic, Ben, you have to use it.
No.
I was going to say, how we found out... Because I think you can talk about this, because how we found out what to do was we didn't start by putting on a sketch night. We started off by putting on a variety night. So there was like seven of us. There's a big group of friends. And we put on a night. We wanted to have everything in it. So we all did stand-up, like 5 minutes of stand-up. We all sang songs and we did sketches. And it was like that was the entire night. It was like a variety night. So we started off being called Pappy's Fun Club because it was an evening, mm-hmm. not an act. And we never thought of ourselves as an act. It was like, come to this show, you're going to see everything, and there's going to be seven of us and we're going to do it. And I think our act now has condensed down from a variety night into our act here. So it's kind of sketches, but music, I think, is like Ben is always the one who will have an idea for a sketch and Ben will go, can this be a song? Can we make this a song, please? And he's always right.
That's funny because we... What was the sketch in this year's show that we wrote it and it wasn't quite working and we were like, we're going to give it to Clarkey. He's going to say it's going to be a song and he's going to be right.
And then we turned it into a song. Ben wasn't even there.
Yeah. We didn't even need Clarkey in the end. We thought, what would Clarkey... We've got a little wristband that says, what would Clarkey do?
We use it whenever we want to lie in.
I quite like the idea of doing the comedian's comedian, where you bring on a comedian to talk about another comedian, but that comedian doesn't speak.
Because
what's happening now is we're talking about Clarkey, but Clarkey's barely said a word. I concur.
That is a potentially award-winning format, and I'd like to stake my claim on it here. Absolutely. Let's do that from now on. So you mentioned that stand-up, and you obviously came to... I mean, Matthew, you're a stand-up in your own right as well. You're a recognised stand-up, and you've done a couple of hours at Edinburgh, the second of which is this year. Tom, I remember you doing stand-up before in 2007 when we did the Hackney Empire
show.
Well,
I actually did my first hour this year at the McClunkleth Comedy Festival, which is a lot like Edinburgh, but... It's like one venue in Edinburgh. That's the McClunkworth Comedy Festival. It's this incredible festival that runs in the middle of Wales. It's beautiful because the industry don't know about it yet, but the comedians do. So there's a lot of great comedians go there.
And everyone has to pass through the filter of Henry Widdicombe.
Yeah, well, exactly.
And he only books lovely people who are brilliant.
And he was lovely. And he said, look, I saw you do stand-up. I know you can do stand-up. Do an hour. Do it at my festival. Okay. So I was like, okay. So I did an hour this year and really enjoyed it. So you never know.
But I always think of Pappy's as being a sort of stand-up infused, because a lot of the things you're talking about, like not respecting the fourth wall, things like that, they're very much like stand-up tropes. So when I first saw you, I remember thinking, this is like a sketch show, but it's also like a stand-up show, because you know, it, quite apart from the gang show idea you're suggesting of a stand-up act and then a sketch act, it was like your sketch was really infused with stand-up.
Well, that's how it happened, in a very practical way, because we were doing our own night, this kind of variety night, and then when by the time that had finished and people had dropped away and we were a small group going out to perform at other people's nights, the only gigs we could get booked at were, because Crosby had been doing stand-up for a year or two on the circuit in London, all his contacts were stand-up nights. He'd say, can I come and do your gig with my group? And they'd be like, okay. So we were only playing stand-up nights to begin with.
Sure.
And we very quickly learned that we always talk about it in terms of direction, like any sketch that's this way, you tank. Any sketch that's that way, you'll survive.
He's talking about playing in and playing out. If we play in and we talk to each other on stage, then those sketches never work. But if you talk to the audience, even though you may be saying things that should be addressed to the other two, then that tends to work.
Sure.
And also, we always treated the first few minutes on stage as getting... Because if you come on and go, hello, I'm the doctor and you're the patient, you know, that's awful. Whereas if you come out and say, hello, we're three dickheads, it's nice to meet you, then... Which is what a stand-up would do. Hello, I'm a dickhead. Nice to meet you.
Yeah.
If we say, we're three dickheads. Nice to meet you. Then they go, oh, I like these three dickheads. Then they don't care when you come out dressed as Julius Caesar. You know, they know you're a dickhead.
Me and Ben were in Wolverhampton doing theatre.
I should just point out, Ben looks like he's concurring with all of this.
Yeah. Before the audience came in, Ben was sat in the middle and he suddenly went, I shouldn't be sat in the middle. And we're like, yeah, you're absolutely right. No, Ben and I were doing theatre in Wolverhampton. So we had a three-man theatre company in Wolverhampton and then this sketch group going on in London. We were travelling between the two. And like, literally, that's the wonderful thing about the difference between theatre and comedy. And sometimes I think sketch falls into that trap of being too theatrical. And the beautiful thing about comedy, why it's such an amazing art form, is that, in fact, it really frustrates me because there are plays that do, you get these plays every so often, like called The Audience, or like, you know, You're Here Too, and it's like, and all the critics are like, oh my god, this theatre piece is incredible, they acknowledge the audience and the audience do a thing, and it might, and you go, that happens every fucking night in every comedy club, and it's a piece of art that's live and real, sure, and the audience are there, and like, if it happens in a theatre, people all jizz themselves, and it's like, go and see a comedy show, that's what comedy is. It's an art form that's completely live and has to be fluid and change to its environment. And I mean, and that's the difference we found from playing the rural touring circuit as a theatre company and then coming down and being able to do comedy shows. And that's why I think embracing that life, it's so important to us.
But also what Tom and Ben bring to Pappy's, which I don't really have in my arsenal, is
driving licenses.
Yeah. Height. Well, I was just about to pay you guys a compliment, but fuck you both.
Yeah.
No, I was going to say that I saw their productions. I saw the productions they did, and they were very, very physical and very, very kind of visually inventive.
Sure.
And that's the side that Tom and Ben bring. So any days that I sort of am not around to write with them and Tom and Ben write together, it will always be a thing that involves a lot of movement and almost often no words. It'll often be like sort of like the silent sketches are often come from Tom and Ben.
Okay.
The very physical silent sketches. Like we have a thing this year called Three Songs, which if you've seen that, that was pure Tom and Ben all the way.
Sure, sure.
I mean, literally I wave backstage while it happens. I text my girlfriend. You know, and that's what I love, is because that's the thing that I definitely can't do. The sketches that are wordier and a bit thinkier come from me. And by thinkier, I mean where people go, rather than laugh. Oh, conceptually interesting, Mr. Crosby. Conceptually interesting. Did not laugh once, but appreciate what you're trying to do.
Do you find, let's talk a little bit then about your writing process. So that you have different days of writing with each other. Is that purely based on who's available at the time?
Kind of, but we find that writing in pairs is a lot more effective when it comes to an initial idea. And also some ideas you think, oh, that'll work well writing that up with Tom. That'll work well writing it up with Matthew. And so it's just kind of finding the right combination, really. And then as a three, then we go back over every sketch and we re-edit it and rewrite it together. Sure. But the initial kind of idea, we find that three on an initial idea can sometimes just kind of just chokes up. It's just too many cooks.
Yeah. Sure. Well, for me, it's really simple because, like, I was talking about this last night, actually. I'm so boring. I was talking about this in I was really boring, a member of Lady Garden with this. But if you... sometimes it'll happen, and it's okay when someone writes a sketch on their own and brings it to the group, but that always takes longer because once something becomes like a tangible thing, then it's much trickier to break it down and change it. Whereas if you're writing in a pair, you immediately start compromising on the idea. So if I've got this idea for a sketch and I say, and I'm with Matthew and I say, right, this is what I think it should be. And Matthew goes, well, actually, what about this? This would be better. And I'm like, ah, okay. Then we're already compromising to make the first tangible thing.
Sure.
So it's already been collaborative. Whereas if I've written a thing, like it happened, I had this idea for a sketch with bears in it for this year's show. Mm-hmm. And rather than we write it together, I wrote it and it was there, and then the guys had to kind of go, well, maybe we should change that bit or that bit. But that's always a lot trickier to do when someone's made something that's whole. Whereas if we've made it together already, it's already collaborative, and then the next person comes in and
it's already open.
And I think so that's why I will always I'll always drink Advocat before a writing meeting. I'll always push for writing in pairs first because it's that you immediately start compromising from the very start. Okay. I think that's quite an important thing.
But also as well, like if we do end up, because there's a couple of sketches that I wrote as a first draft, like I wrote a sketch and then showed it to the other guys and they said, well, there's an idea in there that we like. So we completely through it, like there's we've got a TV show called I Can't Do That in the thing, which was a thing I initially wrote for I wanted to write it for Anna and Katie. Do you remember? You know, Anna and Katie were doing a TV show, but it got turned down. So fuck you guys. and I thought that would be a funny idea. I wrote it out as a script, but the initial script just didn't really work. So we took it. We literally tore up the first draft. And I think sometimes writing a second draft, you think, oh, it should be a redraft of the first.
Yeah,
it doesn't necessarily work that way. Sometimes a second draft should be a new first draft, and then and that's kind of the way quite a few sketches have gone.
So when you say writing and drafts and tearing things up, are you talking about physically you sit and one of you is at a laptop or a computer and you actually physically write things down, or are you improvising together?
That's really interesting, because we do write physical scripts, but once we've learnt the basics of them, we kind of throw them away, don't we? I mean,
at what point in the process? Like, describe from day one of an idea.
Okay. Let's think about this. So say for example, it's like Tom and I sit down. I'll probably be on the laptop. I just don't like. He's so. I mean, we're both slow typers, but he just doesn't know any of the hotkeys.
he hates it when I'm at the keyboard, and he'll go to the toilet, and I'll go to the keyboard, and he'll come back, and there's always a great 4 minutes where I refuse to give up the keyboard, and he can't handle it. And like he goes, you should space that there, and no, that's that you've got to use the tab bar, and then like after about 4 minutes, he's like, get out.
And I always apostrophe in cameras.
I always try and hold it for as long as possible. But so when I'm writing with Matthew sits at the keyboard and I pace around and shout stuff out. And when I'm writing with Ben, I sit at the keyboard and Ben paces around.
Ben's actually worse at typing than you are.
I think so. But like that's that I quite enjoy though having those two writing
partners because they're completely different from me. I can be the one who's throwing stuff out and Crosby will write it down as a proper joke.
Okay.
And Ben can throw ideas at me and I'll try and write that down as a proper joke. And I really like having those two different writing pairs. But it is rare that we script a sketch and it stays, like, here's the scripts for this sketch. Like, the second we kind of talk it through... And then immediately dispense of reading it out, and then it immediately starts to change. So it's very early on. Like, we were thinking about our shows. None of them are... We haven't got any physical evidence of our shows. So when we try and remember our shows from 2007 and stuff, there's not a script of our show.
Okay.
It's not written down. There's set lists.
Yeah.
But it's not a concrete thing.
Sure. I mean, that almost seems like the reverse of what one might imagine the process was, whereby you kind of talked around ideas and then put them in a concrete form. You're kind of starting off concrete and going, yeah, there's something funny in this. That's the funny idea. Now let's play it.
And we write a ton on stage as well. Again, when we first started in like 2004, when we first started doing nights, we would write things. Because we all lived in different parts of the country, we'd get together on Friday night, having written scripts, we'd rehearse them and rewrite them on the Friday night, perform on the Saturday night. So we'd like all day Saturday rehearsal. But what would happen is often you'd be out on stage and, you know, you've learnt an hour and a half long show. You didn't, like, lines wouldn't come as quickly. You would improvise. You would say a thing that didn't work. So all the same things you do in stand-up where you say something and it doesn't work. You have to deal with the fact it doesn't work. So what we do a lot is it's just kind of improvise lines and mess around and never worry about sticking to a script, because the chances are in that kind of the high, the pressure you feel on stage to be funny makes you funnier in a really good gig. You come up with things that you know, it's like if you're being chased by a bull, you can jump over higher fences than you could if you were just running along trying to jump over fences.
We can all relate to that. Yeah.
You seem like a kind of bull chasey crowd. but yeah, I think it's that kind of thing of being, you know, being live is the best way to write.
So apologies for the dodgy start there. This one was a bit all over the place technically. A huge amount of fun, this interview. And one of the many things I love about Tom, Matthew and Ben is that there's loads of thought and loads of heart behind what amounts to a ridiculous, sweaty knockabout performance. If you haven't seen their last show ever, which we'll refer to frequently during this episode, you have to make the effort and go to what Tom charmingly calls the McClunkliffe Festival, and best search for Mac Comedy Online, M-A-C-H Comedy, and go and see the final performance of their last show ever. As you'll hear from the final question segment at the end of the show, they've really raised the bar for sketch comedy, I think, in terms of feeling and of the emotional response it can provoke. And it's also very, very funny, of course. Amazing reactions to the Dr. Brown podcast just before Christmas. Some of you huge fans of his and getting exactly what you wanted. Some of you, as predicted, found the interview very frustrating. All I can say is it's almost impossible to sum up the kind of work we're talking about if you haven't seen it. So go and see him in the flesh if you can. See what kind of work he's doing and what kind of risks he's taking on stage, and then get back to me. And also something that we didn't even get the chance to talk about, which is frustrating, is one of the best shows I saw at this or any other Edinburgh was Dr. Brown and his Singing Tiger, which is his children's show. So I just wanted to flag that up. Whether or not you're a fan of his adult clowning, his children's show is one of the best children's shows I've ever seen. So I wish I'd mentioned that last time. Perhaps many of you will email me and tell me that I did and I'd forgotten about it. That happens more often than I'd care to admit. Now, very excitingly, we have sold out about 2/3 of the tickets available for our special ComCom Live night with James Acaster. You remember this is at a secret location in London on Wednesday the 6th of February. That's just a month away. £6, tickets only available in advance from the comedianscomedian.com website and the Facebook page as well. So comedianscomedian.com has got a link to the Facebook page on it that you can click through to buy the tickets. I'll be hosting. We'll have a short guest spot from someone brilliant, and then James will do us half an hour of stuff old and new. And then after an interval, we'll do an interview with James, and only the interview will be podcast. So do come and hear the whole thing. James is on tour at the moment, I later discover. So what do you want? Do you want the show that everyone gets to see that probably ends up on a DVD somewhere? Or do you want this special intimate experience? It's the second one. This week's Funny for No Money is in honour of James. The fabulous James Acaster has always looked to me like a young man on some sort of geography field trip. It's just his look. So in honour of his upcoming special on Wednesday the 6th, we're doing a Funny for No Money, which I've got to point out, the hashtag is hashtag funny for, F-O-R, no money. Let's all get on the same page here, people, because I've had people email me the phrase... no money, but I'm funny. And I just find it confusing. So it's hashtag funny for no money. And what I'd like you to do is to combine the concepts of geography and comedy itself to find the perfect title for an Edinburgh show. Could be a mixed bill show about those two things. So here's one to start you off on the subject of geography and comedy. Just the Tectonic. I know it's bad. I expect you to do better. And finally, before we go back to Pappy's, here is a new strand on the show, The Death Line. This goes out to all comedians. When you've died, and really died, not just a rough gig, but a death, I want you to ring up and tell me why. Tell me whose fault it was. That bit is a test. What it felt like. We want physical symptoms, the psychological impact, in as much specific detail as possible. And you send them in. I think ultimately I'll get a phone number for this and you can record them on an answer phone, but I'm off to Australia, so for ease of use at the moment, record me a short message, 2 minutes tops, on your phones. Go into detail as soon as you come off stage, as soon as you've died. This is here to be an ear for you and also for us to get out to all of these plucky wannabe comedians that all want to bravely have a go. Let's see if we can stop them by letting us know what it's like to be the person that is making the whole night die, that's ruining everything. I've got one that I recorded myself a little while ago. I've got some recording of the fabulous Ellis James, who had a very shonky one before Christmas. And Tom Tuck, I should say, also helped develop this idea. He's coming up on the show before too long. So get in touch with me, record me a short message, just a short one, otherwise I'll have a nightmare editing, and email it to info@comedianscomedian.com. So start sending those ones in, and they really have to be a death, and you really have to go into detail about what it's like, otherwise I'm just going to bin them. Finally, as ever on the live shows, and I know this has been a long blurb, I can only apologise. Finally, the bleeps at the end of the show are where I've bleeped out audience questions. And on the subject of apologising, I can only apologise for how hard and how annoyingly I'm laughing throughout this interview with the absolutely wonderful Pappy's.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
From the perspective of the sitting down writing or pacing or typing thing, yeah. How long do you have, like, a writing timetable in an average week or month? Do you go, okay, we're going to meet in the office in whatever pairs and we're going to do X number of hours work on these days, or is it more fluid than that?
We tend to go and do office days, don't we? We sort of start about 9:30, 10 o'clock and finish about 5:30, 6 or 7, something like that.
We've got a lot better at it, actually. It's been a real kind of journey for us to get to that point where we say, okay, Monday, I'll go around to Ben's house and we'll work there, and then Tuesday, Matthew can come over to mine. And like, we've got a lot better at treating it like that, especially when it comes around to getting a show together. And what you really learn about those days are... 4 hours of them are really shit. And you sit there with nothing and you stare at each other and you get a bit frustrated with each other and you talk about other things, or like, you know, like you realise that the other person's doing something else rather than thinking about the idea you're thinking of at the time. Ben, get off Gumtree. I know you've just moved house, but fucking hell, we need to write a show. But like, you know, like, and it's like, and like, that's like 4 or 5 hours, and then you'll suddenly hit 20 minutes that go bang, and it's like, and it, the idea will fall out, and you know, and it's been a long time being a writer, learning that that's a massive part of the writing process, is waiting and waiting, because your brain's doing stuff. I read a great article about it, and actually it's a shame because it kind of explained to me what I thought I'd just discovered, when like, you know, like literally if the one part of your brain gets frustrated, the logical part of your brain, mm-hmm. then the other side of the brain starts making synaptic leaps and sure. kicks in. But that side of the brain doesn't kick in unless the other side of the brain is, I'm tapping my head if you're listening at home. but like, unless you frustrate that side of the brain, then the creative side doesn't start making synaptic leaps.
Gotcha.
So a lot of the time is just sitting there and it feels like you're banging your head against a brick wall, and then suddenly, and this is like, this is what Clarkey's so good at, is like, it'll be like, this doesn't work, this doesn't work, this doesn't work. And after like an hour of not saying anything, he'll go, what about this? And you kind of go, yeah, that's it. That's it. Of course that's it. And it's like, you know, that's like, it's just like a turn of the key and then bang, off you go. And you have this incredible 20 minutes where it all like all falls out, and it's like, you can barely type fast enough.
Okay.
But waiting for that, it's like fishing, I think. It's like, you know, it's, I don't fish, but I imagine it's like fishing.
And I don't get chased by bulls, but it's, let's pursue these metaphors. But it's fascinating as well. What also the sort of funny side of things is, I got an email from Tom. I was standing on a train platform with my girlfriend Charlotte, and I got an email, and I just went like really screamed loud, and she was like, "What's happened?" I was like, "Tom has taken one of my character names and changed it to the Bibster. He's made one of my characters called the. It's now called Matty the Bibby Bibster. He wasn't called that. He was called, I don't know, Gerald Bonhuffley or something like that. Not the Bibster." And then she was like, "Is this the most frustrating thing of your part of your job? Because." Because that's, but like you could still, like, we've had screaming arguments about, like, right, well, the.
Go there.
This
go
is,
there.
Yeah, we should go there, because this is fast. Oh, yeah. This is fascinating. Where, well, let's sort of reverse, go backwards. There was a point where Tom said, at the end of an argument, he said to me, "You know what? We're going to laugh about this one day. We're going to laugh about the fact that we've just spent the last half an hour arguing as to whether or not we should start our show by singing the song 'Tonight's Gonna Be a Good Night' by the Black Eyed Peas." Now that was Tom's original idea for how we start our show. We all come out and sing 'Tonight's Gonna Be a Good Night' by Black Eyed Peas. And I was like, no, we should write our own song. That's what we do. We write original songs about how exciting the show's gonna be. And he's like, no, this is how it's gonna work. And we honestly, it was one of the shittest mornings of my life, sat around at Tom's house drinking coffee, just arguing as to why we should and shouldn't do things. Yeah. It's so important to have those. It's so important to knock heads against each other. It's so important. Yes. Well, but also, it's important to remember that you are not. You're annoyed conceptually, but you're not annoyed actually. Tom and Ben are my best friends in the world, and Ben and Tom are best friends. But Tom and Ben are my best friends in the world. So what you've got to realise is that although the person in front of you is saying things that you think are not just wrong, but genuinely sort of show a fundamental lack of understanding as to what comedy is, you've got to they are sent there to make you a better person, and you are sent there to make them a better person. And gotcha. we are far, far greater than the sum of our parts. Like we've all done comedy individually, but I think collectively we work. That's when we're most successful.
It took a couple of years to get to that stage as well, where you to not take anything personally is so important. It's like, I think it's the key to working together, and like we want to work together for as long as we're performing comedy. You know, I think we like and like in the last couple of years, that idea of we're in this for the long term. This is going to be our lives. We're going to work together for as long as possible in whatever way it is. You know, if it's not coming up to Edinburgh within an hour, we're never going to want to stop working together. It's like to preserve that. To make sure that you know you can absolutely say to someone, "You're talking bullshit," that means, you know, you're absolutely wrong, and not take it personally. It's yes. like to have a completely subjective, you know, like, like take all these subjective feelings and make them, this is completely objective. This has got nothing to do with who you are. It's just about your ideas. And it's like, it's so...
That doesn't sound much better, you know. I love you as a person, but your ideas are fucking shit, mate. No, but it is true. It is saying that thing of like, I love working with you, but this bit isn't working.
Sure.
And absolutely. And one of the things, I don't know if we want to get into this, but one of the reasons why we went from a four to a three was because that level of communication wasn't there in the relationship we had as a four piece. And
sure.
And one of the things that we learned through what was essentially a very painful breakup, it was like a divorce, was that we need to be more open and honest and upfront with each other and sort of be a bit kinder with each other. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of... Thanks, mate. Kurt Vonnegut's in the audience.
So regarding that, did you feel that made you stronger afterwards, having gone through a process whereby you had a sort of a messy divorce? Did you feel that the good things came out of that?
Yeah, I think...
I wasn't going to bring that up, but seeing as you have...
Can you see we've finally given Ben the mic as well? Because we've got to the tricky bit.
Yeah, this is...
I'll save this sinking ship. Yeah, absolutely, it did. The thing is that our relationship as a three had already begun quite a long time before the split anyway, because the fourth member was slightly less involved than we were. He still had a full-time job.
Sure.
He didn't like doing out-of-town gigs in the same way. And so our kind of... Our relationship had already started to build as a three quite a lot of time before that. But you think definitely since the breakup, I think it's brought us together more and we're kind of more in sync.
Yeah. Sure.
Is anyone else going to cry now? Right? I think Clark is.
So let's.
But I tell you what was also just like which fits in what we're talking before. One of the things that taught us again to become more live was that when we used to do three man gigs, we got booked for a lot of three man gigs around 2007. We had quite a good year up in Edinburgh in 2007. Got booked for lots of three man. We got lots of shows that were out of town, so we had to do them as a three man thing. And in order to make it sort of financially effective, what they would say is do the whole night. So yeah. We would go and we would do stand up in the first section, and then there would be a break, and then we'd go and do Pappies as a headline set. However, we were such inexperienced stand ups that we would tank in the first section almost every time. So we would be out there doing stuff that we weren't good enough to do individually and not be very successful. And then we'd be like, hey guys, guess who your headliner is? The three dicks you hated in the first half. Back again. But now they're wearing paper hats. That's to improve shit, right? So I think that was another thing, like, again, It was necessity being the mother of invention. We had to, working as a three man, we realised that it's much better to do a whole night of Pappy stuff and be incredibly live at the start and not be scared of stand-up-y type gigs.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. So let's talk about personalities then, and let's talk about personas and who the three of you are in relation to one another on stage. Because something that that is often of interest to listeners of the show who are stand-ups, and the majority of my guests are sort of straight stand-ups, is the development of a persona. So it's fairly... I mean, how do you see yourselves now within the dynamic of the three of you?
Well, I'm the talkative one. Yeah.
Wow, that's your first round of applause there, boys. And it goes to Clarkie. Good work.
That's how it works. We've kind of worked really hard on trying to extend what happens in real life and put it into our personas.
Before we get onto this, can I just say we used to spend a lot of time drawing graphs of what this is genuinely true of what we thought, or like, but not quite graphs, but like sort of visual representations. And we used to try and this was part again, and I know I keep coming back to this, but part of the reason why we realized we were more clearly defined as a three is that we would draw like. we would draw like a body and say, who's the head, who's the heart, who's the hands, who's the legs? Yeah. You know, like, do you remember doing this? Yeah, yeah. And sort of trying to work out exactly what we were doing. And I think we could never really make it, that was never something we could really make work. But I think now there's an element of kind of, I don't know, like maybe I'm head, Clarky's heart, and you're slightly too feely hands. No, I'd say certainly Ben and Tom are much more sort of childlike and sort of they go on instinct. Yes. You know, they sort of, you know, does that make sense?
Yeah, well, I think it's like, let me try and think. It's kind of like in terms of the clowns, it's like math, and I love, like, my favourite phrase in comedy is, I've really found my clown. I love that, yes. But like...
It was in the attic, it was really creepy.
But like, Ben plays like the sweetly stupid guy.
Yes.
Which, you know, I say plays.
No, here's the thing, right? Ben is a really smart bloke, right? It's nice when you have to have someone say that for you. But Ben is genuine. Like, Ben's very smart. He's very visual. So people often, like, it's that thing of like thinking Tom's happy-go-lucky. He's a miserable bastard. But he's honestly, he's very. Is that your miserable face?
We'll get a picture of that and we'll send it out with the podcast.
But it is that thing of like, we are, like, people often, in interviews will go, oh, how do you put up with it? You're always angry on stage. It's like, yeah, I'm playing a character who's angry on stage. Yeah. Like, this is the greatest job in the world. I'm never genuinely feel angry.
Yeah.
So it's kind of funny how people sort of confuse who we really are with who we play on the stage.
Yeah. Sure. The relationship between, it's interesting you should mention clowns, because I do, you could see it in sort of those classical clown things. You're kind of the buffoon.
Yeah.
And Matthew is the Pierrot.
Yeah.
And, you know, sort of like, or maybe Ben's the Pierrot because he has that sort of like the sadness and sweetness.
Yeah,
and
or the, heart, or the Harlequin maybe.
Yeah.
That's why I think you might be as the Harlequin. We did Dell'Arte when we were in youth theatre, and I genuinely go back to when I was Doctore, and I made this mask, and it was like, I had hair back then, but it had a big bald forehead, and he was like this kind of grotesque, kind of quite fat guy, and I was quite thin back then as well, and I, you know, quite quickly, I didn't immediately go bald and get fat, but I really think that had a lot to do with where my comedy persona lies, was by doing comedia and being this quite, you know, I don't know. I think I'm the grotesque of Pappy's in that regard. Like, if anyone's going to come out naked or be inappropriate, or that will be me. And I'm always happy to do that, you know, like, but sometimes I feel like I have to take one for the team by being, okay,
by
I'm the one
the
who's...
disgusting one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, okay. So I'm going to be the disgusting one here. Ben sometimes feel like he has to take one for the team because he has to be the stupid one who's like, oh, well, I thought it meant this. And Crosby has to take one for the team because he's going to be the one who goes, I think you'll find it's actually that. And so, like, we all have to be those parts, and it's like, you know, so disgusting and stupid and anal.
So who is, I'm trying to think who, well, I can't remember who it was, but someone described me, when we were called Pappy's Fun Club, someone described me as the unfun one from Pappy's Fun Club.
Yeah, but you need that,
and it's
perfect.
Like, and it's like, thanks. But like, the thing is, yeah, you do, right, the role I see myself is, because I think we try and reflect our audience, and that's what's good about sketch comedy for us, or the sort of stuff we do, is that we can, if something goes badly, rather than an audience member going, that was shit, one of us can tell, like, we can heckle each other from the stage.
Yes.
So I think there's that element.
But I remember one of your opening lines years ago used to be, you'd come on and go, it's a sketch show, but don't worry, it's not shit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You were thinking sketch comedy, it's going to be shit. That was what a lot of people would, actually, we stopped doing that because you can plant that negative. Daryl, when we used to bomb at his gigs all the time, Daryl Martin is a promoter for Just the Tonic, but we used to come out and go, we're gonna do some sketch comedy, you know, you're thinking sketch comedy, it's gonna be shit. And he said, although it isn't shit, enough people hear you say it's gonna be shit, and it's that sort of Pavlovian response of going, oh, it might be shit, you know. So I think that was a very early trick we used to do.
I remember Sue Perkins years ago called her second show The Disappointing Second Show, which is a funny title in the context of that's maybe people's expectations of a second show, but it's still a show title which includes the word disappointing.
Yeah, absolutely.
We kind of keep, because one of our, we used to do that a lot, was kind of like, we realised how much sometimes you apologise for what you're doing on stage as you go along, and we've really tried to move away from that and be like, do you know what, we think this is funny and we don't need to apologise for thinking it's funny. I think a lot of comedians have techniques to actually be defensive about what they're doing, or almost apologise in a way, or be meta about things, or be like, and actually anyone who's being meta on stage, I always think it's still a fucking joke that you've written. We were talking about this a lot, don't we? Like, you've written that joke, and even though it's a different type of joke to the one you want to be doing, it's still a joke you've written. Don't apologize for it, just put it out there. Like, you know, like we have a lot of groaners in our show, like where people groan, and I always think an audience enjoy a groan as much as they enjoy a laugh. I think like it's part of being, you know, like the different, you know, you can be manipulated in lots of different ways. And I think giving the audience a chance to groan, or giving the audience, my favorite joke is when an audience get it just before you do it, and you have that very satisfying thing of, hang on, it's going to be, yes, it is. And it's like, yeah. And like part of the laugh is an audience rewarding themselves for having got there, or being like, that's my favorite moment is when you know you've got it and then you're going to do it anyway. And like, and I think there's nothing wrong with those. They're all different types of jokes, but you don't have to apologize just because it's going to get grown. And like, we tried to really cut back on apologising for what we're doing.
Well, one of our favourite comics, sort of collectively, is Tim Vine, and he does proper stinking jokes. That's one of the sort of things he does. Like, I mean, he has some of the greatest, most beautifully crafted jokes as well. But he loves bad puns and stuff like that. But what is so brilliant to watch about Tim Vine, and Harry Hill is the same way, is that he comes out and he sells it, and he doesn't go, like, there's not that sort of slightly sneery, like, come on, we know this is bullshit. He does that proper sort of showbiz. He puts his arms out as he comes out on stage and makes it in a, come on, all of that kind of stuff. It's really, that I find that so much more endearing to watch. Somebody who is, rather than being snide about their material, going, isn't this brilliant, isn't this wonderful? It's sort of celebratory. Yes. You know, you can sort of celebrate the sort of slightly sort of chonkiness of it, you know. It's I think that's kind of what we aspire to do, isn't it? Sort of, you know, to be celebratory of things that are very, very silly. But equally, having people, you know, if Tom's doing something silly, Ben and I can still be looking at him like, come on, guys, this is silly, to the audience, so we sort of reflect that there.
Sure.
Just very quickly, last week I overheard a conversation between Tim Vine and somebody who is like kind of, not a reviewer as such, but is really interested in comedy. And she said, I've just written a piece about comedy and how the function of comedy is to make people think and laugh. And Tim Vine just went, no, it isn't. It's to make people laugh. Because you laugh and you feel good. That's it. And like, and I think that there is and obviously there is a great strand of comedians who make people laugh and think. But like, I absolutely want to make comedy that makes people laugh and feel. I think that's, I love the idea, and I think that's what, it's why, you know, we try and do it in our show this year, is kind of that sense of emotional manipulation to a certain degree, because I find that such an enjoyable experience. You know, when you go to see a musical and you're like, I know this is a musical, I know this isn't like an investigative piece of verbatim theatre that matters, but God, I'm crying and then I'm cheering and I've got goosebumps because I'm being manipulated by this nonsense, and it's such a lovely feeling. And like that fear to feel something instead of thinking, I think, and I love the.
It seems to be much more in tune with comedy, doesn't it? Comedy, if you're laughing, that's a spontaneous,
it's
uncontrollable
involuntary reaction. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think that's the same with when you get goosebumps or when you. And like, we always talked about, we never quite managed it. I think David Reed came quite close last year. We were talking about, I'd love to do a sketch that's really funny, but then proper fucking scary, like horror show scary, like, oh my God. And like, I love that, because when people come in to see a sketch show, they think they're coming in to see one thing, and that's a great place to be. When you're to have an audience and you go, right, you think you're here for this, maybe we're going to do this now or this now. Like, you, it's a great thing to have an audience thinking, expecting one thing, and then go, right, well, I can do things with you now because you're expecting one thing. So, right, here we go. Let's
and
see what we can do with you.
Comedy is uniquely placed to do that, because you can always do a thing and then do a joke.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whereas you can't really chuck a load of Grand Guignol horror into a, you know, a romance without everyone going, we want our money back.
Yeah.
And also with the joke, you can just kind of instantly, you can kind of wipe the slate clean. No matter what you've done that precedes it, making someone laugh, kind of, it's like pushing a reset
button. Or choose not to. And without, well.
Can I say very quickly, what we've learned about in terms of roles is making an audience feel something. We absolutely know that Ben's the best person to do that, because an audience always feels like they don't feel sorry, that's not what they sympathize with Ben, or they have an emotional connection with Ben that they don't have with Matthew and I.
And often when he's silent as well, if you think of the dinosaur.
I am always pushing to if we ever get a show that could be on telly or something like that, like I always say Ben should be a mute. He should be like, because it's like, right, because it's Wallace and Gromit, right?
Yeah, it is.
Or Harpo Marx. Yeah. I think, like, I mean, you know, there's a lot to be said for, you know, silent comedy. I mean, like, you know, the artist was massively popular. I'm sure there's going to be more silenced stuff happening soon. Mm-hmm. So it seems crazy to say, like, because you can't speak, you can't be funny. But if you think about the fact that we still remember the comedians of the silent era, like everyone knows Lauren Hardy, everyone knows Charlie Chaplin. The comedians of a little bit later, like American comedians from like the 50s and 60s, you might not know a Jack Benny, you know, you might not know a Milton Berle, but everybody knows, and that's international. Sure. So there's something really, really, really wonderful about that, right, Ben? Exactly. Now... But I genuinely think, and I think that's another thing that we like to do as well, is have an element of pantomime in the kind of traditional sense, not as in like panto, but as in, that's what Ben and Tom are really, really good at, is that kind of those physical things where we've got loads of sketches now that are silent sketches set to music, and they always tend to be sort of Tom and Ben sketches, but they're some of my favourite sketches to watch, because it's, you don't need to know sure. anything, you just enjoy them for that.
We're gonna have to wrap up fairly soon, because we started late. I know this is we're loving this. We'll keep going until they throw us out. I'll just mention now, I've got another couple of questions. If you want, and we can do a couple of questions from the audience if we have time. So have a think now. We'll come back to those in a second. Regarding TV, you've had a couple of pilots, and how have those gone? What's the experience of doing Pappies in a TV studio as opposed to in a small venue with a low ceiling and sweating all over everyone?
Well, we know how to do live comedy, because the tricky thing is when you're doing when we're doing little gigs in front of our family, we were learning how to do it. You know, we spent a year when we weren't on the circuit, but we were performing every month doing a brand new show. Whereas with a telly show, you're suddenly doing it. You know, like you can practice stand up in little clubs. You can't practice telly on sort of little channels. There aren't, you know. Well, there are some little, you know. But you can't sort of do like a few little things, and then especially sketch. You know, there aren't people. There are very few shows you can come on and do one sketch, and then you go off and do something else. So I think it's always been the thing of, and also we're so good at working with each other. When you make telly, there's a ton of people who don't necessarily understand what your comedy is,
and that's for me, that's the fundamental thing about television that I struggle with, is because the great thing about comedy is you have control. Everyone in comedy, I think you get into comedy because you want complete control over what you're doing. You're there, you can change what you're going to do on stage because you have absolute control over it, whereas to be on television, there's somebody over there who is controlling what the people at home are going to be seeing, or how they're going to be seeing it. So timing and cutting away and things like that, you have no idea of.
Need a fourth member of the sketch show who is the editor, who's come up with you the whole time.
Absolutely. I can't stand the fact that there's somebody over there who is going to control how this thing looks like, because all I want is, and I know, like, that's why I hate the idea of filming our gigs and watching them back, because as from a performing point of view, like, fucking when we do our stupid homemade costumes in our heads, certainly for me, and I think for you guys as well, it's like when Ben puts on his shower cap and things like that, like, I'm sure he thinks he looks a lot more like a dinosaur than he actually looks. And like when I used to put on like the Black Knight's hat and be the Black Knight, I used to feel like I was in chainmail. I used to feel like it. And like at the end of the day, I'm just a knob in a t-shirt and shorts with a fucking cardboard tube on my head. But from my eyes looking through those cardboard slots, it's like I am this knight, and you go, it feels like everything. From a cold television camera's view, it looks shit. Yeah. And in a way that when an audience is in a room with you, they almost make that leap with you. They make that creative leap. You say, okay, here we are. This is what this is now. And people go, okay. Whereas from a television point of view, it's so difficult to make that communication. And I think visual, I mean, aesthetics are such an important part of what we do. Yeah. And I think I always remember, translate that's very difficult.
I always remember Richard Sandling saying that you guys spent hours making props to look like you'd spent 2 seconds making them.
Yeah, that's kind of right. People like people always describe our stuff as like sort of crappy looking or homemade looking, but genuinely like a lot of
I've got the word crappy on my notes.
You've got crappy, yeah. But it's fun. Like genuinely, that's the way we want them to look. Although there are two ways. Sometimes they're the way we want them to look. Other times we make a prop because it's not worth again like spending a lot of money on new material. If you're doing a joke. As a stand-up, you can do a joke. If it doesn't work, you get rid of it. But if you're doing a joke that requires like 3 or 4 props, mm-hmm. you've got to either buy them or make them or mm-hmm. whatever. So if we buy them or if we make them and they work, we go, well, that works. It works if Tom's wearing a hoodie with loads of crisp bags sort of gaffer taped to it. He's a vending machine now. That's him as a vending machine. We don't need to go out and make a proper vending machine costume because that's what it is. Although I will say one thing, and this is one of my favourite aspects of sketch comedy, is that if you are a stand-up, you say a joke, you go, that didn't work. The audience kind of thinks that you just made it up on the spot and it wasn't funny. That's yes. fine. Whereas if you... we had a sketch in our 2008 show, which we previewed in London. We were just previewing this one sketch. We'd written it that day. We were going to preview it that night. And it was called The Owl Versus the Internet. And it was like the old source of knowledge versus the new source of knowledge. So an owl does battle with the internet. And we didn't know the sketch that well. And Ben was on stage sort of introducing the sketch and it was just tanking. It was dying. We were having a horrible time. And I was backstage... putting on a jumper and rubber gloves for talons and a little furry hat going, they're going to know I've planned this. Not only is it not going to be funny, but I'm going to be on stage. There's no way they're going to thought, he just made that up. He's made that up on spur of the moment. He's gone away. He's made a costume. He's going to come on dressed as an owl. And then Tom had to come on covered in cling film. It was awful.
With a golf club for an arm, I seem to remember.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like the internet hat.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a great very quickly, but like we were previewing a sketch 4 years ago about Brian Adams, where a time travelling terrorist had gone back to the summer of 69 to kill the spirit of rock and roll, and instead of the music shop where he bought his first real six string, they replaced it with a pet shop, so he bought a pet instead of a guitar, so Brian Adams never wrote the summer of 69 and rock and roll music never happened. And then I came out as Brian Adams wearing a denim jacket covered in animals and said, actually I have wrote a song, and then it was the summer of 69 but to music sounds, or it was Clark who was Brian Adams.
To animal sounds. So it would be like ruff 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 ruff, meow 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 meow. Right. Oh, you laugh now. We died every fucking time we did this sketch.
And it genuinely took me 2 days to make the jacket, and I sewed every single cuddly toy onto a denim jacket. It tanked and it tanked and it tanked, and we couldn't get this Brian Adams sketch to work for love nor money, but that jacket has sat in my house for 4 years biding its time, and it is in this year show, and it gets a laugh on stage, and it makes me so happy.
Ladies and gentlemen, I was planning to keep going until Neil comes and stands in my eye line. I can just see you over there, Neil. It's 20 past. We went up a bit late. Can we have another 5 minutes, do you think? Get in. Hooray! Hooray for Neil again. So any questions from the audience? There's a lady over here. I'll ask through me and I'll say it into the mic in a minute. So when you're writing the work for the podcast, Bangers and Mash, does that change in the way you write the structure of the day?
It does a little bit, yeah. Because what we'll do is we'll for those who don't listen to the podcast, we get together, we have a little improvised chat for about half an hour, and then we listen back to that. And as we're listening back, we think, well, this bit we could write a sketch about this, or that bit we could write a sketch about this. And then we go away, write sketches, record them, and drop them in at the points we've in the conversation.
Like a plate of Bangers and Mash. So the chat is the mash and the sketches are the bangers.
Yeah. Just one question, Tom. If the chat were our pants, then what would the sketches be? So, so what we end up doing is then it's a very sort of super fast version, because we need sketches done by 4 o'clock in the afternoon. We start about midday. So we will chat through ideas, and sometimes it will literally be a one-liner where we'll go, here's the first line, here's the outline, that's it, that's what it is. Or we'll chat through the ideas over a cup of coffee, and then we'll go away and write individually. And more often than not, it's certainly got to the stage now where we don't we will kind of suggest little lines, but we don't really re-edit each other's sketches.
Mm-hmm. I think that's partly why a lot of people ask us, oh, you're not using any sketches from Bangers and Mash. And it's funny, we've done a year, like nearly a year's worth of Bangers and Mash, and yet there's hardly any sketches that have made it from that podcast onto the stage. And I think that's because fundamentally we're all writing solo, and there's none of that collaboration really. We make a few changes, but it's very, because it's so quick, it's like solo writing, and then we knock them out. And I think we feel very differently about those sketches than the collaborative sketches that make it into our Pappy shows.
Yeah. Also, they're very contextual to the actual because it comes out of the conversation. They don't really work in any other context than the conversation. And also, okay. they're not quite good enough.
Great stuff. There's another question from Kurt Vonnegut. Sorry, that was how you referred to earlier on. Apologies. Is so, just to repeat that, and I think it's worth repeating, that this gentleman thought your sketch show was one of the most moving experiences he's ever had in a theatre, to which Tom looks pleased and Matthew a bit concerned. But that's not...
See more theatre, mate.
but nonetheless, the
go
show
see
is...
The Trench, it's brilliant.
The show is called Last Show Ever. Is it your last show ever?
It might be, because it might... I think in terms of an Edinburgh hour... I think unless we can come up with a reason to... If we come up with it, like, one of the great... Well, I think it's a great joke. One of the great jokes we thought of is, like, we'll come up next year with a show called Reunion Tour. which would be really funny. But it depends. I think conceptually, we really saw this show very early on. And, like, we can really see our Edinburgh shows. There are those that have arrived with a big, strong concept right at the start, and it's almost like, right, we know what the show's going to be, let's go and make it. Mm-hmm. And that was the case this year. It was the same with our world record attempt. It was like, as soon as we knew that was the concept, the show is there, it's just colouring it in. Sure. Whereas in previous years, that's been different. And I think unless we think of a reason to do another Edinburgh Hour, then I'm not sure we will, just for the sake of doing an Edinburgh Hour. And actually, you know, I think we love this show, I think, more than any we've made so far. And I think unless we can think of something that's a good enough reason... I mean, like, we're never going to stop... Like I said, we're never going to stop performing together or working together. Whether we do another Edinburgh Hour or not is remains to be seen.
Is there a sense in your minds as to where it can go next, as to where, like, in terms of Edinburgh, if you look at someone like Boy with Tape on His Face, he's come back and now he's doing the Grand and it's 750 and he's selling out every night because it can kind of scale up indefinitely. Is there a point at which you think Pappy's has like a maximum room size that works for it? Or
we're actually in a smaller room than we were in previous years. We're in the Pleasance One in 2009 and 2010. We're now in a room that's about half the size. Actually, it's about half the size of the Pleasance One, and I think that's like, I think it's too. Our agents, which is a tricky thing, our agents will often say, you've got to show the industry you're stepping up. But that's why they say play a big room. You've got to show the industry you're stepping up. But I think if you show people that you're stepping up, I don't care about the industry, but people in general, you show that you're stepping up by doing a really good show. Yeah. And we wanted to write a show that was suitable to that. So I would happily do a show in the Upstairs. I think the Upstairs in the Pleasance is an incredible venue. Mm-hmm. Happily do a show in the Upstairs. We don't equate it in terms of audience numbers. We equate it in terms of how proud we feel of the show.
Sure.
And how much people enjoy the show. And that's something you can immediately feel. So I don't really mind. Like, we've done that room. The Queen Dome, which we were in this year too. I think the first few shows we had like 70 people in, 80 people in, you know, preview shows. But it still felt great in that room. It still felt wonderful. Whereas in a big venue like that, it wouldn't necessarily. So I don't know. I think it's just, I see it in terms of creativity. That's the challenge, isn't it? It's challenging yourself to write better jokes, write better sketches, and just be funnier. And also, the other challenge which stand-ups don't have is it's stay together. That's the challenge for us.
Oh, no, that's a challenge for stand-ups as well.
Do you stay together with yourself? Yeah. Stay mentally together. But I think it's incredible. Like, I haven't seen Tape Face's show this year, but I think... That's really exciting. It's really exciting that he's doing the Grand, isn't it? It's like a really... Or like our mates, the Actors of Awesome, who we sort of, you know, we've have known for years. It's brilliant that they're in, that they're doing massive venues. But I think if you're doing like big visual stuff, you could do it in a venue. Big songs you can do in a venue. I think
We're a little act.
I have no desire to play big rooms. My favourite thing about performing is it helps me if I feel like I can look at every single member of the audience. Like I always say throughout the show, I love making a connection with every single member of the audience, and I love seeing somebody who's not enjoying it, and I'm like, well, I'm going to look at you and do it to you until I know you're enjoying it. Okay, you're enjoying it, that's fine. Okay then, come on then. Okay, we're on board guys. Like I think inclusivity is such an important part of our shows, and I want everybody to be like, okay, let's, you know, like we always say to our staff before the start, let's do this team, let's have a good show, everyone, to everyone in the room. And you want to say it to the audience, it's like, okay everyone, let's do this, here we go, we're gonna have a great time here. Crosby always used to say, get on board or fuck off, and it was like it was a great line, because it's like, together we really need you guys to make this work. If you're not gonna get on board, we're gonna have an uncomfortable hour, but together we're gonna make something special here. We need you to be a part of that. And it's so much harder to do when you know there's somebody, you know, in the third tier or whatever, you know, like that far back.
Yeah. I think we have to leave it there purely in terms of time. And get on board or fuck off seems as good a place as good a place as any to leave it. Ladies and gentlemen, would you please join me in thanking the wonderful Pappies? So we mentioned Pappy's Bangers and Mash podcast there. I think that's been on a hiatus, but I think it's back. Also, the Flatshare Slamdown is very, very funny. So go to www.pappiescomedy.com for links to both of those, Bangers and Mash and Flatshare Slamdown, both very excellent podcasts. Tom mentioned at one point in that interview, if we ever get a TV show, and as I'm sure many of you will know by now, they have. So look out for that on BBC Three this year. I'm not sure of the title of it yet, but it's a Pappy's sitcom, a Flatshare sitcom, where the boys will be pretending to be much younger and more hip than they are in real life. Yeah, I still say hip. Just a reminder, Wednesday the 6th of Feb, Slim Jimmy Acaster in a special ComCom Live. Tickets only available online at the website comedianscomedian.com. Get in quick, we're 2/3 sold out already. And I was going to, it's all going a bit manic at ComCom, I was going to say Towers, Hotel is probably more appropriate. Or lay-by. Yeah, it's all a bit manic here at ComCom lay-by, because I've got lots of travel coming up. So I'm not sure which ep is coming out next week, but we've got a few live ones left from Rod Gilbert, from Terry Alderson, and from Jim Jefferies, so probably one of those. Plus, I've recently recorded the wonderful and lovely Rob Rouse, and also we've got an interview with Tom Tupp coming up soon as well, so look forward to those. That's everything. Thanks to BBC Worldwide. Thanks to all the usual people. If I've sounded faster than usual doing this, it's because I'm incredibly hot under a duvet trying to block out the sound noise in this hotel I'm in Sheffield. That's the lot. Bye.
We love you, Brendy.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
A little something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional, unprofessional. So if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.